Welcome back, everybody. It's July 2018. My name's Amit Maini, and this is the Australian edition of EM Wrap. I hope you're all doing well. This month, we've got a slightly longer than usual episode. Chris Greenbridge and Mike Noonan talking about traumatic cardiac arrest and also where the medical arrest crosses over into the traumatic cardiac arrest and where the algorithms cross over. Take it away, fellas.
Today we're going to talk about traumatic cardiac arrest. I'm joined by a colleague and friend, Mike Noonan, who I work with in the emergency department here and in the trauma unit. And this segues quite well because last month, Mark Fitzgerald talked about thoracotomy and resuscitative thoracotomy in the emergency department specifically. And so I think it's good that we take a closer look at all the nuances of managing the patient in traumatic cardiac arrest. Now, Mike, I know you had a case recently of traumatic cardiac arrest. So it'd be good to hear about the case.
It was an interesting case, actually, and I think it's important just to put people in the picture of where we practice as well, Chris, who may be listening from outside of our area in Victoria, Australia. So we obviously work in quite a high-volume trauma centre, and our population is a bit different to what you might find in North America. We have 95%+ of our patients that come through the door are blunt traumatic patients. So a small percentage of penetrating trauma, and in comparison to, say, shock trauma in Baltimore, who probably have around 40% penetrating trauma and similar numbers as us. So from that perspective, we certainly do see lots of blunt trauma and have high exposure, given that we're one of the biggest centres in Australasia for trauma. The case is quite interesting and brought out a few key principles, I think, for me, for how to manage these patients. So we had a call out of a 50-year-old male who was involved in a high-speed motorbike accident. He low-sided the motorbike and went into a pole. It was UCS 15. He was tachycardic and had blood pressure, which was around about 100 systolic on the call out. And the ambulance was around 15 minutes out from our hospital. No clear signs of chest trauma, but the ambulance officers were concerned that he had potentially some abdominal trauma and some lower limb injuries. He came via our helicopter emergency medicine service, our HEMS service, and they are staffed by MICA paramedics, some extended scope practitioner paramedics that we have in our region who do very good work and have quite an extended scope of practice in their abilities in trauma. They were able to give the patient blood en route, and the patient required that blood because his blood pressure had actually dropped. The call-out time was quite short, so we only had 5 to 10 minutes to actually prepare for this patient. And the patient arrived and basically was found to have no output or arrested on transfer across to our ambulance trolley. The resuscitation ensued fairly well from there. The patient was in what appeared to be a non-shockable rhythm, and actually at that stage, the team actually moved to ALS, closed-chest CPR, and at the same time actually instigated some key life-saving interventions that we suggest are important for trauma patients.
So just to set the scene then, so you're in one of the trauma bays and you had a good team of people, so you had consultant-level staff, you had yourself the trauma consultant, an emergency physician.
And anaesthetist there as well on arrival, as we normally have with our patients. The patient was started along this path of ALS based on the fact that there was a concern that he may have a cardiac cause of cardiac arrest as well as his traumatic causes. And he'd had a previous sternotomy. It was clear by examining him. He had a big sternotomy wound. At the stage that he deteriorated, it appeared that he may be bleeding from somewhere around his pelvis. However, it was a bit unclear. And they were concerned that his deterioration was rapid and may have actually been a cardiac cause that actually led him to crash in the initial stages. So suffice to say that he was moved across to our trauma bay. Closed-chest CPR had been started by the ambulance officers just prior to transfer. The team decided to do an initial rhythm check in ALS while they prepared to actually treat the cardiac causes and also the traumatic causes of cardiac arrest. So there was a process of drawing up adrenaline, the patient had pads applied, and they proceeded to do a rhythm check while a team was actually prepared to decompress his chest. So I suppose if I pick that apart a little bit, this patient has potentially a number of competing pathologies in terms of potential management. And it's something that we see certainly even in our across our system quite frequently, in that patients who have arrested after trauma are also treated with the usual ALS protocol.
I mean, I've come across this situation where the ALS protocol is being enacted, and as the person coming in trying to get people to stop doing what they would normally do in an arrested patient can be challenging. They obviously, they're trying to help the patient, the chest compressions, all the interventions that would normally be done in an arrested patient, trying to get them to stop doing those things to allow you to do what I would describe as the meaningful interventions for a traumatic cardiac arrest. That can actually be quite a challenging encounter. Was it an issue on this occasion?
I think it was. I was informed about this and was on my way into hospital at that point. And certainly speaking to the team who was involved, it certainly was. And I think in my mind, it's worth dividing out for the audience those two specific indications, if you like, or management pathways for the arrested patient. There's a very well-beaten path with ALS in cardiac arrest, and that has the ability to take over from potentially the treatable causes in trauma, as you've alluded to. And even in a mature system such as ours, we do see this happening. The way I look at these patients is that there's two pathways. There is a patient with a likely cardiac cause of cardiac arrest, which is our usual ALS protocol, which involves the instigation of early chest compression and defibrillation and the chain of survival, which is quite clearly understood across the world. However, in trauma, there's potentially causes that need to be managed either in parallel or apart from that. And the challenge we often see is that the usual ALS protocol, which targets cardiac causes of cardiac arrest by and large, actually is fairly well not useful in the patient who is a traumatic cardiac arrest. There isn't much in the way of guideline around what we do with traumatic cardiac arrest. However, probably the most up-to-date guideline is, in our area anyway, is the ANSCoR guideline around the management of arrest due to trauma. That's actually a really clear guideline and has some of the most up-to-date evidence. It was published in 2016 and can be found on the Australian Resuscitation Council website. And it does talk to this point. It talks to the fact that usual measures in ALS may actually distract from the most important interventions in the traumatic cardiac arrest. And certainly I think that's something that's very important to be aware of as a team leader, but also as a team follower when you're involved in these cardiac arrests. The key interventions that are talked about in that guideline involve treating the cause of shock in trauma. And those causes, I think, can be divided fairly clearly into hemorrhage as probably the most common cause of shock in trauma, but also obstructive shock being probably the second most common cause of shock in trauma. Hemorrhage control initially involves managing external hemorrhage. The other things that we can do to actually control hemorrhage in the trauma bay involve simple measures such as placing a pelvic binder, such as reducing long bone fractures. So those things are important. However, in terms of initial interventions, they should occur in parallel to the treatment for obstructive shock. The most common treatment that we'll instigate for obstructive shock in the traumatic cardiac arrest would be bilateral pleural decompression. And I think the important thing to bring out with that is completely independent of any examination. And I think that's something that should be underlined. A patient in traumatic cardiac arrest needs to have bilateral pleural decompression.
And we would recommend formal finger thoracostomies, open thoracostomies, rather than needle in this setting.
Absolutely. We know that supine chest x-rays in trauma are unreliable. There was a paper by Kilpatrick which looked at this, and it suggested that around 30% of the time patients will have clinically significant hemothorax or pneumothorax, which is not picked up on the supine chest x-ray in trauma. So I think we can be fairly clear that patients who have the potential for tension pneumothorax, i.e. The traumatic cardiac arrest, need to have both sides of the chest taken out of the picture and immediately with bilateral finger thoracostomy. I think the other thing to be clear on with that is that this does not need to involve putting a chest tube in immediately. And the procedure of finger thoracostomy can be divided from the procedure of chest tube placement. And the life-saving procedure is the finger thoracostomy. For other causes of obstructive shock, we'll think about looking for and potentially treating cardiac tamponade secondary to trauma. And that would be the other common cause of cardiac arrest that we might see in the trauma patient. So that's, I suppose, a flavour of those two algorithms. And in this case, obviously, those two algorithms crossed over, and I think probably appropriately. And as a senior team leader in trauma, I think actually knowing which protocol to follow is sometimes challenging. And I think this case highlights that.
There's probably some human factors in there as well, in that the people in the team want to be contributing to the resuscitation and chest compressions and adrenaline and the cycles that they're used to in an arrest. They want to follow those things. And I think as the team leader, recognizing that that's a powerful motivation and explaining that there is a small number of interventions that we want to make sure occur, and sadly, the chest compressions can get in the way of us performing them. So that's how I often approach it, is to say, we can do that, but we need to do these things first. And there's a short list. I mean, some of the pre-hospital services I've worked with have used a mnemonic of the HOT principle. I don't know if you've come across that, which is deal with the hypovolemia as a cause, which is, as you say, the hemorrhage control and provision of blood products. So trying to correct the hypovolemia. Oxygenation, so ensuring that there's a patent airway. And that's best done in our centre would be to have an intracranial tube placed and see an intertidal tray. So tick off hypovolemia, tick off treating the oxygenation, and then the tension disease. So as you say, the tension pneumothorax, bilateral finger thoracostomies, and then a consideration of whether there might be a tamponade physiology as well. And really, once you've got those things ticked off, that they are the reversible causes. And if you haven't got a return of spontaneous circulation at that point, then you're really into the situation of, is this the end of the resuscitation, or is it, Do we return to our medical thoughts and continue with chest compressions and the medical algorithm?
I think you're absolutely right. And there's something cathartic for a team in running an ALS algorithm. It feels familiar. People obviously train in it a lot. Our nursing staff are very adept at that. And it's sometimes difficult to actually move that momentum as a team away from doing chest compressions, away from doing the things that we know save lives in cardiac causes of cardiac arrest. And I think, as you say, those principles of managing the traumatic cardiac arrests are very important. And I think if we were to flip the paradigm, for example, if we were to see someone who fell over who clearly had chest pain before they fell, and we were to actually start doing bilateral pleural decompression on those patients, then it would just not be appropriate. And I think we need to think of this in the same way. If we think that the most likely cause of their arrest is traumatic, then I think we need to treat and manage those as a priority before we actually flip to the other side. And those things can happen in parallel, as you rightly say, and particularly if you've got a team who's involved in that. But if you're in a situation where there's closed chest CPR occurring and you know that there's certain interventions that need to occur to allow that patient to have adequate survival, then obviously we need to intervene at that point.
I think you make a great point about survival in that this isn't a futile thing that we're talking about. The studies have shown we get survivors from traumatic cardiac arrest, blunt survivors even, and the numbers are not terrible. I know that Dave Lockie from London HEMS did a paper and they had a 7.5% survival rate in their pre-hospital traumatic cardiac arrest group. So it's, you know, these are numbers comparable with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest from all causes.
Yeah, it's interesting because we actually looked at our numbers here in a Reboa study, which actually is coming out soon, where we looked at the utility of Reboa in our organisation over an 18-month period. And of these patients that actually came in shocked who met the criteria for Reboa, there was certainly a good survival rate through that process. And these are patients with significant trauma. And of those patients that we had through that actually triggered that protocol, there was a 60% survival rate in amongst those patients. So I think it's an important thing just to be aware of, as you say, that this is not a futile thing once a patient arrests in trauma. We can talk for hours, as we often do, about things like thoracotomy and the indications for that. But I think certainly the simpler processes such as bilateral pleural decompression, external hemorrhage control, pelvic binders, splinting, triggering massive transfusion, large bore IV access, good access to arterial or invasive blood pressure monitoring, those simple things that people are far more familiar with are probably more life-saving in many ways than the two or three thoracotomies that we save each year from blunt trauma. And so I think that's something that, although they're sexy topics, we need to stick with the basics and do that well. So going back to this case, the patient actually did have a blunt cause of cardiac arrest, but he also had potential cardiac cause of cardiac arrest. And with that in mind, obviously those two algorithms were run in parallel. So the patient was, while he was in the ALS algorithm, was intubated within about 10 minutes of him being in hospital, had bilateral pleural decompression. They'd done a rhythm check. They had given him adrenaline because they thought there may be some changes on the ECG. They thought there was some cardiac cause that was potentially contributing to his condition. He had a negative pericardial window on the ultrasound, which was the binary step to look for that cause of obstructive shock. He'd had large bore IV the access above the diaphragm in the form of a subclavian MAC line, which, as you know, is something that we use quite frequently. And he'd had the massive transfusion protocol instigated. Within 15 minutes of him arriving and all that occurring, he had return of spontaneous circulation. And at that stage, a more detailed secondary survey was undertaken with the patient, who appeared to have an expanding hematoma in his left flank. And it turns out he had a fracture through one of his lower thoracic vertebrae, which posteriorly, which actually caused a bleed into his retroperitoneum. So certainly this case, you know, highlighted for us that importance of being aware of the causes of blunt cardiac arrest, the causes of cardiac arrest related to ALS and cardiac causes, and really that crossover between those two.
Did the compressions continue for a lot of the resuscitation, or...?
So the compressions continued through the first 5 to 10 minutes, but there was an awareness at that stage that the patient needed to have some life-saving interventions in trauma run in parallel. And I think it's a really pertinent question, because the question of when you stop, I think, is an important one. You've had lots of experience in the pre-hospital. What are your thoughts around that?
I'd really like to tick off that list, because I think also cardiac arrest can run for a long time. And in a medical setting, we have a rule of thumb about how long we run an arrest for. If you've got, you know, if you're in asystole and you run an arrest, you don't usually keep going beyond half an hour, say. Whereas in traumatic cardiac arrest, if you perform all the meaningful interventions and you've got no cardiac output, you've got cardiac standstill, you've got asystole, at that point, I don't think continuing for the 30 minutes or however long is your rule of thumb achieves anything. And so I think actually the meaningful interventions need to occur, and if you don't succeed in recovering the patient, then you can actually stop at that point, because the things that might be reversible have been attempted and no return of output has occurred.
Yeah, I think it's really important to think of it that way. I agree. I mean, when we run an ALS algorithm, we think about H's and T's, and I think the HOT that you're talking about, but I think that's a really good way of thinking about it, because it just allows you to go through the reversible causes. And I think if closed chest CPR is in the way of you doing those life-saving procedures, particularly pleural decompression, and obviously thinking about whether they need to have tamponade released, which it will, then you need to actually really take the hands off the chest to do that.
But it's also probably worth stating that it's not that we're anti-compressions, it's that the compressions probably achieve nothing in those conditions. So if you're hypovolemic and you've got an empty heart, squeezing it isn't going to help. If you've got a tension in the thorax and no venous return, squeezing the heart isn't going to help. Tamponade, same thing. So I think it's not that we're anti-compressions, it's that the meaningful interventions need to occur, otherwise the compressions aren't going to be able to achieve anything.
Absolutely, and as you know, with these patients, they're often in a low flow state. Mm. They often will have some cerebral perfusion, but what we're trying to do is improve cerebral perfusion or perfusion to those important organs. And if we're doing chest compressions and it's not actually improving that cerebral perfusion because there's obstructive shock from whether that be a tension pneumothorax or a tamponade, then as you rightly say, it's actually not useful.
Yeah, and it may distract from performing the stuff you need to get on with.
Absolutely. So I think it's a key thing to take out of this. You had a patient that was a blunt trauma cardiac arrest.
I did, and the arrest had occurred a lot later, though. So this was more of a peri-arrest situation where it was the middle of the night, same thing, came in from home, and I got in just after the patient arrived. And in terms of the diagnosis, it was quite straightforward in that when I walked into the room, they were just completing the FAST scan, and there was obvious pericardial effusion and tamponade physiology, and the non-invasive blood pressure just flashed up with a blood pressure of 60. So they were really in that group of patients who we would think about starting a resuscitative thoracotomy in the emergency department. So our local protocol was very, very clear that in penetrating trauma with a blood pressure less than 70, we would consider doing a resuscitative thoracotomy in the ED. And then in blunt trauma, blood pressure less than 70 with evidence of tamponade on the ultrasound scan would again prompt consideration of an ED thoracotomy. But I think it's important to say that we wouldn't just go ahead and crack open the chest. We would do the things that might help first. So start an appropriate blood transfusion and decompress the chest. So bilateral finger thoracotomies to decompress the pleura. Because ideally the patient would have their thoracotomy done in the operating theatre with a trauma surgeon or a cardiothoracic surgeon. Because our skill set really is pericardotomy, relieving the tamponade, but may not extend to controlling the other things that you might find once you open the chest. And that's exactly what happened in this case. So bilateral finger thoracostomies and massive transfusion achieved a blood pressure of around kind of mid-90s. And that gave us time. The blood pressure was maintained with transfusion, and the cardiothoracic surgeon arrived, and we took the patient to theatre and they had a thoracotomy in the operating theatre. So the cardiothoracic surgeon performed a left lateral thoracotomy to start with, and just as the finicetto retractor was going in, the patient lost their output. And as soon as the pericardium was opened, they regained their output. And the case progressed, so the bleeding that had caused the tamponade was from the back of the heart, so from the pulmonary veins returning to the left atrium. And actually, that's quite a difficult area to control, and certainly from as an emergency physician, it would be an area that I would definitely struggle to get hemorrhage control of. So having the cardiothoracic surgeon there was a really good outcome. If we'd done it in the ED, the outcome may not have been as positive. So the hemorrhage control was achieved with just squeezing with the fingers initially, and then actually we progressed to a clamshell to gain better access to the back of the heart, and the pulmonary veins were, the cardiothoracic surgeon achieved hemorrhage control by suturing. And certainly in this case, so the patient did very well, and I think there was a chance that had we done the thoracotomy in the ED, we wouldn't have got hemorrhage control, and they may not have done so well. So I think if you can get the patient to theatre, then absolutely that's the appropriate thing to do. There's also going to be patients who perhaps shouldn't get a thoracotomy even when the evidence of tamponade is there. And I'm thinking about patients who have really very severe head injuries, potentially. So if there's deformity to the head and there's brain on view, those patients really probably shouldn't get a thoracotomy because, as we know, hypotension and head injury is a very bad combination. You know, their brain is likely to be irreversibly damaged, and performing the thoracotomy is not going to improve the outcome. And then the other patient are the very high spinal injuries. So sometimes we do shoot through lateral x-rays of the C-spine to look for craniocervical dissociation, because that really would be a contraindication for me starting a procedure that's not going to change an outcome.
So just picking that apart a little bit, Chris, so who are the patients that you would consider doing a cross-table C-spine? Because our common practice would be obviously a chest x-ray and a pelvis x-ray. And is there a particular group that you would actually do that on that would change your management?
If I'm concerned that there's a high spinal injury, so there are going to be things that point me in that direction. If there's priapism, or if there's been a period of bradycardia with the shock, and also just the really badly injured heads, the ones that clearly have taken a lot of force, I think that if I'm about to embark on a procedure such as a thoracotomy, it'd be good to, as you say, a shoot-through C-spine x-ray can be done very quickly with a gantry set up as it is. We can get a quick look and decide about progressing.
Yeah, I agree. I tend to find that it helps my decision-making around the next steps. Obviously, most of our patients will try and get to CT, even some of the metastable patients that we bring through our department with co-located CT. However, if I'm going to actually undertake procedures that potentially put my team at risk, and thoracotomy comes under that category for me, I would, in a patient with a significant head injury on clinical examination, I would do that cross-table C-spine. And
one of the questions that often come up are patients who have dilated pupils or fixed dilated pupils. And I know you and I share our views on this. Do you want to talk to your thought process when you see that in this setting?
Yeah, I think certainly head injuries as a sole injury is actually very difficult to prognosticate upon. And as you know, we see these patients in the ward who we think have unsurvivable injuries who actually do survive, and actually defining an unsurvivable injury in the trauma bay is very, very difficult. That said, that discussion around fixed dilated pupils is often comes up when you have patients who you're considering interventions such as thoracotomy. I don't find it useful personally. I think there has been certainly some support in the literature around that. I know a neurosurgeon from London, Mark Wilson, has done some research looking at this, and certainly there is disparity around patients who arrive with fixed dilated pupils who actually do have some survival. So I don't think we can actually really comment on those patients very clearly at the point of making these decisions in the trauma bay. For me, it's more the combination of the severe head injury with the high cervical spine injury. The head by itself, I think, is sometimes difficult. As you say, those cases like brain on view, I think, are perhaps very different. But a closed head injury by itself does not actually stop me going forward and performing a thoracotomy. However, the cross-table C-spine with craniocervical dislocation with a severe head injury in the multi-trauma patient, that would be a patient that I would actually call the arrest at that point.
Mike, one of the things I think that comes up is the human factors of these resuscitations. Obviously, it can seem quite frantic in a resuscitation where cardiac output has been lost. Can you tell me some of your strategies for getting the team to work together towards sort of common goals, that sort of thing?
I think it's a really important question, particularly when you have people of different skill mix in the room. And one of the most difficult situations I find as a team leader is actually getting the team on board with the fact that you don't want to do normal ALS. So I suppose it starts at the call out. And from my point of view, and I know that that you share my views on this, but we have a standardized approach to the reception of a shock trauma patient. That involves the team, so the human resources. It also involves the equipment setup. And it also involves the attitudes of the team and how we actually interact. And I think all those things are really important. For the case that we talked about, for example, what the process I would normally instigate would be is to actually do a team pre-brief to say, this is what we're expecting, these are the expected injuries, and this is the expected course of the patient. I would have the shock trauma patient trolley set up on either side so that I can actually instigate what I know to be those life-saving interventions. So I'll have, on the right side of the patient, I'll have a trolley set up with a chest tube and the ability to do pleural decompression. On the left side, I'll have the same trolley set up, and I'll have an operator on each of those trolleys scrubbed ready to go. I can add things to those trolleys. The usual thing that I will add to those would be a MAC line so that they can actually also gain subclavian access. I'll also have plus or minuses for that trolley, and that may include thoracotomy, depending on the call out. But we have thoracotomy kit in our emergency department, as you know, it's easily to access. And often we'll have that sitting in the back of the room. And that's an awareness from the team and the nursing staff that this may actually be a patient who requires that. So I think that's an important step. The other things that I'll set the room up with will include an arterial line. I find that essential in that early resuscitation of the shock trauma patient to know where I'm going with the resuscitation. I'll also have a RIC line and on each side, which is a rapid infusion catheter, which can be used to upsize a peripheral cannula and actually allow me to get good peripheral access for high volume resuscitation. In terms of other equipment, we'll have our level one infuser, which we still use in our hospital, and I'll have that primed with blood if I'm concerned that this is a shock trauma patient. We have the availability of pre-hospital blood, and so with that availability, that means the patient may well have arrived after receiving 4 units of red cell concentrate, and therefore the first thing that I'll actually get the blood bank to send me will be actually fresh frozen plasma, which, as you know, in our organisation takes around 20 minutes to thaw. So that will be the first thing I'd like to have there if time allows me. So I'll have those ready, and we have a nursing staff team that actually mans that that level one, and they're actually separate from the rest of the resuscitation team. At the head of the bed, there'll be one of our anaesthetic colleagues managing the airway. There'll be one of our trauma registrars either scrubbed or involved in doing the primary survey. And as well as my 2 proceduralists, one on either side, there'll be usually a third senior proceduralist who will be there, who will actually assist with any procedures that need to be done. And they will be credentialed in thoracotomy if that's required. And so they can actually perform that procedure. That can be anyone across our organisation, from emergency to trauma surgery service, for example. Along with that medical workforce who is already there, we'll usually try and ask for a senior member of the staff to be doing the fast scan, because that's a really important thing to change my decision-making around the patient's next port of course. There'll be a team leader, and there'll often be an additional senior medical staff member from the trauma service or a senior surgical service, or one of the other senior emergency physicians who'll be there as a support member for that team leader. And they can help to manage processes in the back that are not immediately related to the resuscitation. Things like getting the patient to interventional radiology, speaking to the radiology consultant, speaking to surgical teams around planning for the procedures that may need to occur for that patient. Our radiography colleagues will be in the room ready to take their x-rays. And if we have that pre-briefing with that team and we're suspecting that that patient may have a head injury and maybe that case that requires a cross-table C-spine imaging, then we'll have that set up, because that's not part of our usual process. So we have our team, we have our equipment ready, and then it's really for me around a discussion of what we're going to do next. And that early discussion around allocation of roles is very important. But I think the next step, once those that equipment is set up, is actually a discussion around what we expect will be the course or the clinical course for that patient. That sometimes happens on arrival, and it sometimes happens prior to arrival. Ideally, it would happen prior to arrival, but as you know, sometimes situations evolve quite rapidly. And therefore, I think it's important to have that strong team leadership presence. But I think a culture of followership is really important as well. And what that means is that senior team leaders in the room can actually have the ability to derail processes around team leadership if there's not clear followership. And I suppose I like to see it as a hub and spoke model, the team leader being the hub, the other senior members and junior members of staff being those spokes who can feed information to the team leader. The team leader doesn't need to make decisions necessarily entirely by themselves, but they certainly need to have the ability to take on information, filter that information and feed that information back to the team in a very clear and concise way. If we think about the situation of the patient who arrives who is in arrest, you have then another team coming in and joining your team, and that is the pre-hospital team. And that can be quite a challenge depending on the integration and your work relationship with that team. We have a very good relationship with our pre-hospital team here, and therefore often the team leader will have to take that charge around transferring the patient across, when that transfer occurs, if they have chest compressions ongoing, and what the priorities are at that situation. So for me, that prioritisation in the case that has the potential for a medical and a traumatic cardiac arrest would go something like, this patient is in arrest that's likely caused by blunt trauma, and so we need to actually gain rapid IV access. I'll actually delegate that role if that hasn't already been done. And then I'll ask the operators who are doing chest compressions to pause chest compressions while we decompress the chest, instigate chest decompression, get the ultrasound operator to do a fast scan to look for pericardial tamponade as the first procedures that we'll do. And then we can think about running everything else in parallel, such as putting pads on if we think they need to have a usual ALS cardiac cause of cardiac arrest undertaken. And at the same time, after that primary survey is undertaken, reassigning one of my medical staff members to do a secondary survey and look for those external signs of hemorrhage that have not already been identified and treated at that point. Once that first 5 to 10 minutes elapses and we have found most of the injuries that we have found and treated those, then the next step would actually be having a trauma team timeout and actually pausing the team, having a recap, reassessing our priorities at that stage and working out where we're going next. In our hospital, the most common next destination would be to the CT scanner, which is co-located. However, that may be theatre. And also there are times when we bring theatre to the patient, and I don't think that location of the patient should actually dictate whether they have theatre or not. We need to be able to bring theatre to the patient in a hospital such as ours. Following on from what I just said, it certainly has been mantra for many years that you don't take an unstable patient to CT, and it may be controversial what I'm saying around the next steps for the patient. However, I think it's really important to bring out that the CT is no longer considered, certainly in our hospital, the donut of death, and actually it's more often considered the donut of truth. And that's because we get so much information from the patient going through CT, and it's much more common to take the metastable patient to CT, and we will quite commonly, as you know, Chris, give patients ongoing massive transfusion resuscitation with hemostatic resuscitation and low systolic blood pressures. We'll get them through CT because for that particular pathology, it's actually much more useful to have the information of the CT. I think that's far more important for the blunt trauma than the penetrating trauma. And I think our patient mix actually means that we do this more often. And I think those people who are listening in places that have a high incidence of penetrating trauma may see this as insane. However, for us, it's very important to get that bit of information. The particular cases that we would see that it would change their management would be really the cases that would go to intervention radiology. So the thoracic aortic injury, for example, the retroperitoneal hemorrhage, knowing where a patient is bleeding from intracranially and limiting scans to those particular areas potentially may actually help us to get the patient to the right place first rather than going to theatre for what may actually not be a surgically accessible hemorrhage, for example. And that is it's a really important thing to take home.
Mike, look, I know we've talked about a lot of things there, so we should probably just summarise. Cardiac arrest, there's ALS principles on management. And although the ALS or the ANSCoR guidelines do refer to traumatic cardiac arrest, there's a very specific approach that we want to take to the meaningful interventions that can be done when trauma is the cause of the cardiac arrest. And we talked about the HOT principle, so H would be hypovolemia. And practically this involves gaining hemorrhage control, IV access, and then transfusion. Oxygenation, so ensuring airway patency, and that would usually be indicated by an intertidal trace and often an intracranial tube. And then the tension disease, so either tension pneumothorax or in some cases tamponade. And so once those reversible causes have been dealt with, that's your kind of standard management of traumatic cardiac arrest, as opposed to the algorithms of a medical cardiac arrest. Well, thanks, Mike. That was a really interesting discussion. I think we covered a lot of ground, and hopefully we'll get to chat about these things again.
I'm sure we will, mate.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Chris. Thanks, Mike. We will see you next month on EMRAP. Bye for now.